Let's read together to order. Six, five bills on the agenda today. Four of the bills are from committee members, so we're going to go right to Senator Fredrickson's Public Facilities Authority. As part of the stimulus a federal program, and this is Senate File 1329. Welcome to the committee, Senator Fredrickson.
You may proceed. Chairman, members, thank you very much for hearing this bill. This bill would provide for the Public Facilities Authority to spend about $107 million that's coming from the federal stimulus act that was recently passed. We just received the bill last Friday and got it into bill introductions by 11 o'clock Friday. There are actually four co-authors on the bill also. There will be tomorrow after floor session. Senator Tomasoni, Cohen, Anderson, and Rosen will also be authors on the bill. As I said, we'll be receiving about $107 million of funds for drinking water and also wastewater treatment systems. Mr. Chairman, what this bill would do would change some of our existing law to allow for the expenditure of that money and also write some new law that also would provide for the spending of the money within the guidelines of the federal law. I have Mr. Terry Coleman from the Public Facilities Authority with me at the table. And, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, what I'd like to do is have Mr. Coleman go through the bill for you because he knows the nuances and the details of the bill.
That'd be fine. Welcome, Mr. Coleman.
Now, Mr. Chair, committee members, I'll do a quick overview first. The bill provides roughly $72 million and $800,000 for clean water, roughly $35 million for drinking water, and those funds are appropriated to the state revolving loan funds. The demand for clean water is a lot greater than it is for drinking waters, and EPA is allowing states to transfer 30% of the drinking water funds, that amount, to back and forth to either program. So we intend to transfer 30% of the drinking water money, which does not have as great a need as clean water, over to clean water. So we should have a little over $80 million available for clean water. And I'll talk clean water first. The federal law requires 50% of the funds at a minimum to be used for grants. And they also requires 20% to be used for a variety of energy conservation, water conservation, innovative treatment projects, or green components. And that the best direction we've had so far. EPA has said they're coming out with a four-page guidance document to further clarify or define that 20% set aside and what all that means. But as a general rule, we'll be looking at stormwater projects, stormwater retention, as well as any wastewater stuff that does like energy conversion, capture methane gas, cogeneration, things like that, which starting to become more and more standard in the wastewater industry. So there's a lot of requirements. What the first thing the bill does is really allow us to make grants, because the federal law has prohibited states from making grants out of the Clean Water Revolving Loan Fund for wastewater. It has allowed in the past a small portion of the drinking water funds to be made to grants to disadvantaged communities. We need to change our law to give us the authority to make grants and on the wastewater side and on the drinking water side, open it up a little bit. We restrict the use of grants on drinking water only to those systems that are high cost and have an urgent health threat, like radiochemicals or arsenic or bacterial contamination in their water system that need treatment. So we provide limited grant funds there. The federal law, like I said, allows up to 50% of the funds to be used for grants. They require that the grant funds be provided to those communities that otherwise could not afford a loan or disadvantaged communities. We have talked to them about because there are a lot of requirements tied to this that allow us to give a 5% base grant to anybody that gets stimulus money to cover all the program requirements, or at least to make up for those costs. And so far they said that sounds fair and reasonable to them. So we'd provide a base grant to anybody that receives stimulus funds up to 5%, up to $2 million for those base costs.
We're applauding you. Listen to all your testimonies.
Mr. Chair, if you want me to mention some of the requirements, I'll gladly do it. Otherwise, I'll just pass that on, because they apply to all stimulus projects for the most part. Otherwise, we're looking at high-cost projects. We've previously worked with PCA when the drinking water program was created and defined disadvantaged communities as those communities where the costs exceed 1.4% of median household income. So we're in the statute, we're looking at that as the threshold for disadvantaged communities for the grant funding. So when a project cost exceeds 1.4% of the median household income, that's operation, maintenance, debts, and debt service, we will provide an 80% grant for the cost over and above that.
Have you done all the applications and everything? Is that all done?
Mr. Chair, the board approved us to go down the list to 35 points. We had a cutoff on the project priority list of 45 points this year, and we're going to go down to capture more projects. We were shooting for around $200 million worth of projects this year. We've done 146 to date, and we have another $200 million that say they're ready to go between now and the end of the fiscal year, and we anticipate doing another $200 million with the stimulus money. And our ability to sell revenue bonds in the market between now and the end of the calendar year. So this will probably be close to triple our normal construction outlay with the funds we're getting. So that's our goal. We've got a list, the current what's called intended use plan. Every year we have to adopt a plan on how we intend to use the federal capitalization grants that we get. We did that back in last July based on the standard funding that we would have. We had the cutoff at 45 points. The board authorized us to amend that with the stimulus money, and we were going out on public notice. The letter went out to all permittees yesterday in the mail, so they should be getting it by Friday, and we'll open up a three-week period for them to provide any comments, and also opening up that list so anybody on that list from 35 points and higher that want to proceed between now and July 1st, we will amend the IUP, put them on it, and if they can bid it, we'll fund them. Come July 1st, we'll start a new fiscal year, and we'll start all over with an intended use plan again, and that will be adopted sometime in July. We'll be adding more projects because we are restricted to projects that are on the current project priority list at PCA. They will be providing us with the new priority list in June, and we'll be developing the intended use plan in July. So what we know today, we'll fund a lot of projects, and come July, there'll even be more projects on the list. So that's kind of our plan of action, committee members. The drinking water program is almost identical, in the exception we already have the grant-making authority, but we want to change that to eliminate the restriction that there has to be a severe health threat. Just any drinking water project that is eligible to receive a loan and meet that affordability threshold will provide the grant funding for that. The only permanent change in our program that we're seeking is the ability to do 30-year loans. Right now, our current federal law under the Clean Water limits our loan capacity to 20 years. They have, by rule, allowed us to purchase municipal securities with maturities up to 30 years. And since we call it loans, but in essence, the mechanics of it is we buy a general obligation bond of a municipality. That's how we make a loan. We negotiate the purchase of those at a subsidized interest rate. So we're, with EPA's approval, They do restrict that 30-year to communities that are disadvantaged. That is, can prove they need the extra maturity length to keep the systems affordable. So we're going to use the same criteria once they hit 1.4% median household income and cost, allow a 30-year loan instead of a 20-year loan. And that would be a permanent change in statute to avoid two-year rule writing process.
Senator Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that point of affordability, as we've had a number of communities in my area try to achieve cleaner water and wastewater treatment, we've run into issues with the federal local share requirement that gets the monthly fee up into the $60 a month range. Is there any changes being proposed to that mechanism to make these things work better for some of these smaller communities?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scull, I think you're referring to USDA Rural Development, which we partner with, and some of this money, as far as the grant portion, the statute also allows us to match their grants. They used to have a median household income threshold of 1.7%, and we, with legislation that was passed last year? They agreed to lower that threshold down to 1.5% median household income if the state would match the grants by 65% instead of 50, because they were worried about losing their loan dollars, because they get a lot more loan dollars than grants. So if they lowered that threshold so cities would be eligible for more grant dollars, which we asked them to do, because it was getting to the point where people just couldn't afford water or sewer, because that's 65. Well, they have a minimum of $40 a month for water and $40 a month for sewer. So cities that are upgrading both, you're talking $80 minimum, but a lot of times it runs in the $65 range. So we're trying to bring that down, but it's not cheap by any means.
And Mr. Chair, then, we have made some progress there. It's like 30-year loans, you're calling them. Does that have any impact on the? I mean, it obviously would affect the jurisdiction's payback, but how does that translate to the resident's monthly bill? Does it at all?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Scull, I haven't run any sample projects, but our interest rates are so low, like in the very small communities, they're eligible up to 4% discounts based on our rules. Cities under 2,500 population. But we do have a minimum of 1%, so it's really stretching the principle out from 20 years to 30 years. That does have a significant impact on the monthly cost per household. So once they trigger that 1.4% of their median household income, not only do they get 80% of the cost over that, if we have the stimulus money, we will stretch their loan portion out to 30 years. And our average loan rate, we give 1.5% discount to everybody regardless. And then the cities under 2,500, the higher the cost, the more discounts they qualify for.
But should be very affordable, then, you'd think, you know, for what they get.
It is. And people look at the bottom line like using our program. So.
And, Mr. Did I hear you say then that all communities would be eligible for the 30-year with this change, or was there a trigger?
EPA only, Mr. Chair, Senator Scull, EPA only allows us to do the extended terms to disadvantaged communities. So, and we define disadvantaged communities, any community, once they hit the 1.4% median household income. Because we figure that after that, they're at a distinct disadvantage, whether it's being competitively economically or whatever.
Thank you. Thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Coleman, in addition to the federal stimulus money, there's the legacy money that will be coming online after July 1st of this year. And have you been able to figure out how that will fit into this, or are we waiting to see what happens here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, the clean water funds from the sales tax, we have not in office, and I'm curious myself, put a spreadsheet together that combines both stimulus and clean water, primarily because we're very confident we're going to have all the stimulus money under contract before we're allowed to receive any of the clean water funding. But it's definitely a tool to look at in keeping these systems affordable.
Is there, Mr. Chairman, is there any indication how much you think you'll be getting?
The question is, I think it is, how much legacy money is the clean water thing going to generate from the constitutional amendment that the folks voted on? Is that correct?
Correct. Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, actually, the bill you introduced yesterday, the appropriation bill, has the governor's request for the PFA in it, which is, I believe, in the first year, half a year's worth of funding for each of the three programs that were created in the Clean Water Act that Senator Frederickson carried a couple years ago. And those three programs are the Small Community Wastewater Treatment Program. We requested $2 million a year plus a quarter of a million a year for technical assistance, which is 100% that goes to grants. Technical assistance goes to grants to cities to hire designers to replace septics and the U of M to help them develop a plan to operate and maintain, as well as oversight of the septic replacement. The second one is the total TMDL grant, or the total daily maximum load grant, which is for those projects that have a discharge, communities that have permits to discharge in clean water or bodies of water that have been determined to be impaired under the TMDL process. And there's an implementation plan or TMDL plan that identifies and allocates pollutants to various sources, like how much pollutants is agricultural responsibility, how much pollutants are municipal responsibility, whether it be stormwater or wastewater. And when PCA issues the permit and requires an additional reduction in pollutant discharge, that whatever it takes to cover that cost is eligible for a 50% grant under the TMDL grant program. So that is kind of where it goes. And then the third program is the phosphorus reduction. That's to pay for phosphorus treatment being added to municipal wastewater treatment program or facilities across the state to address what people have long time considered to be the number one problem as far as lake quality.
That's where the money goes. But we were interested, at least I was interested. I thought that the Tomasoni Center was.
That's
asked.
Probably too much information.
Well, that's what I was thinking, but I didn't say anything.
Money's in his.
Mr. Chairman.
How much money will it generate per year of the Legacy Act that will benefit your division?
Roughly a third of the sales tax going to clean water.
Millions.
Been targeted to the municipal infrastructure so far, but we assume that's going to be up for discussion every biennium as these studies get done and people identify where the need is greatest to clean up the waters. Yeah, I think they're talking $68 million in sales tax this year.
There, Senator Frederickson, he figured out what I was asking, and Senator Thomas.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and I think 27 is.
About a half an hour ago. But anyway, Mr. Chairman, I will move the bill and ask that it go to finance.
Mr. Chairman, I do have an amendment I'd like to have you put on the bill. It's rather technical. And I have an oral amendment to the one amendment that's being distributed.
Okay, it's the A0108 amendment.
And, Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, if you would be so kind, on page 2, line 14, delete wastewater and insert drinking water. You can include that in the motion to amend. It's just an incorrect drafting reference.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the A090108 amendment and incorporate the change that Senator Frederickson just
suggested. Any discussion on the 08 amendment? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Is there any, I would guess, any money go to the metropolitan area in a program like this, or much money? Or
Mr. Chair.
I think their structures are pretty well.
Yes, the $2 million cap for up to 5% of the cost, and I understand that council has four projects.
The Met Council?
That would qualify for $2 million each, so that would be up. For 5% if the projects are that expensive. I think they got two that qualify for $2 million. each, and then two that are around 1.4, 1.5. Plus, what I've been told from PCA is the 20% set aside for green technology. They've got one community they're working with now, City of Owatonna, and then they anticipate the rest of that as far City as projects Owatonna. Ready to go in the near future once we open up the RFP are going to be methane and wastewater or stormwater.
Want to mention that the City of Owatonna one more time? Maybe you caught it.
Anyway.
He pretended like he didn't hear catch that.
But, yeah, as far as the green technology piece goes, when we open up the RFP, as far as known projects that are eligible, we put on the list and ready to go that we know of, most of those are going to be.
Mr. Greg Johnson from the League of Cities, Minnesota Cities, did you wish to comment on this legislation?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. I can keep my comments very brief. I'm just very happy to be here trying to help the state get more money out faster, and it includes grants for cities. All of these things, as you all know, are desperately needed. We have communities all over the state trying to finance not only drinking water and wastewater systems, but also meeting new stormwater requirements. And this federal stimulus money is eligible for all three of those categories. It's going to make a tremendous difference both in economic activity in our cities, the ability of cities to have new businesses and have the necessary water infrastructure to support them, and getting projects done that have been on the shelf waiting for a long time. So thank you much. These changes help us get there.
Badly needed. Who's on your board, just for the nuts of it? Who appoints?
Mr. Chair, my board member consists of the six state agencies that we commissioners from the six state agencies, and it's Deed as the chair. Then there's PCA, Health.
Okay, that's enough. I just was curious.
Finance.
Senator Rosa, did you have a comment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kuhlman, and I apologize, I came in late, but how ready do these projects have to be? What's the criteria for these to be considered?
Senator Rosen, half of the contracts have to be in place within 120 days, and they all have to be within 1 year.
Okay.
And the calendar started February 17th, by the way, or it's February 17th, so we're about a month, so it's really 90 days from now.
And the law is very clear we need to go on the...
Did we miss a month, or were we slow here, or was it just that's the way it is?
As they bid. I mean, they have to be in the list, but in order of that they're ready to go.
But the 120 days started February 17th.
Correct. We have until June 17th.
Okay, Senator Tomasoni. Any further discussion? Moves that Senate File 1329 as amended be recommended to pass and send to the Finance Committee. Further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, very good. This is
Mr. Chairman,
this is
members,
good stuff.
Thank you very much.
This is good.
Good
legislation.
Good stuff.
Helps when we get a lot of money from somebody, too. Yeah. Senator Bonnef, did you... understand some of your people have to move on to another committee. So, Senate File 1198, Senator Bonnef, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm here to present Senate File 1198. Senate File 1198 is a policy and housekeeping bill brought forward by the Department of Employment and Economic Development, and the bill does have an author's amendment. Do you have that in front of you?
A big bill.
Not yet, but I guess we set the desk.
Okay, and this just gets the bill in the shape that we'd like it in and is mostly technical in nature.
I would trust the author on this one. At 09, Senator Bonnef moves the author's amendment. All those in favor? Oh. Senator Sparks, I'm not so sure he wants to trust the author on that. On the Bonnef Amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Bonnef.
Thank you. And the bill is in four articles. Article 1 is deed policy and includes several small policy issues. Article 2 is deed housekeeping, and so Chuck Hamilton will be describing these sections. Articles 3 and 4 are the product of the UI Advisory Council, which is a council that's made up of legislators, business, labor groups, including the State Chamber of Commerce, National Federation of Independent Businesses, the Mechanical Contractors Association, AFL-CIO, Teamsters Legal Advocacy and Temporary Staffing Association, and I do sit on that council, and so that is why I'm pleased to bring this bill forward today. These articles do have minor policy changes and housekeeping changes. And I will say that, Mr. Chair, when you brought forward the provisions early in the session, we already were able to make those happen. Those were the significant things that we needed to get done this year, and so I'm pleased that we were able to do that. And so these are more minor in nature. I
think we did that within the first week or something.
Yeah, that was wonderful.
We had to get it out the door, I remember. Yeah. Senator Butler.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Hamilton.
Mr. Chairman, good afternoon, members. My name is Chuck Hamilton. I'm the Director of State Services for the Blind and a member of the Deed Legislative Team, and it's in that latter capacity that I'm here today. As Senator Bonoff indicated, Article 1 is the policy provisions within this bill related to deed, but not UI. Sections 1 and 2 of that first article actually have been taken care of in Senate File 684 that has passed off the Senate floor, which extends the definition of the Biobusiness Development Infrastructure Grant Program. So that one's done. Somewhere down the line here, we'll be probably amending that out of the bill. Section 3 of that is related to the Minnesota Investment Fund. As a review, the Minnesota Investment Fund provides financing that creates and retains high-quality jobs on a statewide basis with a focus on industrial, manufacturing, and technology-related industries. This particular change today would expand the use of that fund in the renewable clean energy market development arena. Specifically, it would expand to allow low-interest loans for renewable energy, training grants to support renewable energy workforce, and external marketing to garner more national and international investment. Both sections 3 and 4 accomplish that on pages 2 and 3. Section 5 on pages 3 and 4 actually relate to State Services for the Blind Vending Program, just like you have the gentleman upstairs on the second floor. This clarifies the relationship of the blind vendor to the state of Minnesota as it relates to workers' compensation. Specifically, we had an incident in the last year that has never happened in the 70 years of this program where, in fact, there's the potential that the state may be viewed somehow as an employer to the blind vendor's employee in one of our businesses in greater Minnesota. There was an injury. That person did not have workers' compensation insurance in place, even though the rules and contract required of it. Therefore, we wish to clarify that relationship, something we've always thought was there, as did everyone else. This section also includes some reviser style changes, both in the policy section as well as in the deed housekeeping, as well as in places in the UI portion of this bill. There are reviser style issues, and I'll try to point those sections out when they occur. Section 6 of the bill, page 4, relates to the vocational rehabilitation program. This really just streamlines audits for entities that are seeking funds for, and they're primarily community rehabilitation programs, seeking funds for from the extended employment program. We're really looking at audited financial statements as the best method to determine, as well as the budget, but to determine their financial viability for the next year. That ends the deed policy. The housekeeping piece, kind of a summary first. Commissioner McElroy asked us this past summer and fall to go through all the department statutes as well as other places in state law where we have impact and determine whether or not there were changes that we needed to make. We did find a number of them. As most of the members will remember, there was a merger in 2003. We did do a housekeeping bill in 2004. We thought we got most all the cleanup, we didn't. We are trying to do that again. Much of the housekeeping revolves around a couple of items. One of them is to change the old name Economic Security to Deed. One of the other major pockets is changing from...
All of these are in Article 2, is that correct?
All in Article 2.
Okay. Mostly technical, but go ahead.
Technical. I'm just trying to summarize them, and if you'd like to go through them, fine, but...
I don't think so, but okay. I could highlight a few that...
Okay, I'd be happy to do that. We're changing the title from Job Training Partnership Act to Workforce Investment Act. One of the things I guess I would really note is there's a section that looks like a not like a lot of new law. Excuse me, like a lot of new law. I'll get it right. When the department has been put together over the years, we've bolted on statutes into different chapters. We find that the commissioner's duties were in a variety of different chapters. What we're doing is consolidating those into one place. Similarly, some fiscal language about what the commissioner is supposed to take in, federal grants, gifts, that kind of thing. We have neither added duties nor subtracted duties, similarly in the fiscal area too. But it does create a number of repealers at the end. We have tried to bring those to the attention of the staff in a meeting in this past week. We worked very closely with the revisor's office to make sure we got it right, and I'm sure we did. But there's a lot of different pieces. It was very, very complex work. Mr. Chairman, unless there's specific questions, I know you'd like to move along.
Section 21 has the repealers, right?
Correct.
Okay, we're going to go on to Article 3. I don't think there should be any questions on that. I've looked it over, the Article 2. Article 3.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I'm the Director of Legal Affairs for the Unemployment Insurance Program. As Senator Bonoff indicated, this is a product, Articles 3 and Article 4 are a product of the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council, which is made up of the various groups, as the Senator indicated. There's only two particular provisions of the Article 3 I'd like to highlight because I think they make some fundamental changes in how things operate. The other provisions are extremely minor. I'd like to highlight Section 12 on page 32. This requires employers who are filing appeals through an agent. In other words, a third-party agent is filing an appeal on behalf of an employer. That could be an attorney, that could be an accountant, or it could be a large service company, which there are a few. They must file an appeal online. This will save over $150,000 a year in employee costs, simply processing those appeals. If they file it online, the system will do everything, including schedule an appeal automatically. So it will be a substantial savings, and we can use the funds elsewhere to better administer the program. I would like to also bring up Section 14 on page 33. Right now, the only way you can detect fraud by an applicant, we do various cross-matches, but then we need specific information from an employer, what exact work was performed by the individual in a given week and how much their wages were per week, because otherwise employers file it quarterly, only in broad amounts for the quarter. So we need that weekly breakdown to determine whether somebody committed fraud. We send out 60,000 of these notices per year. Over 20,000 are not returned. There's no incentive for an employer to return it. Example, an individual worked for one company, was laid off, then went to work, collected benefits, went to work for another company. Of course, the worker didn't report that they returned to work for us, continued to collect benefits. The second company has no incentive to return these other than, well, have no incentive to return them. The solution is put a penalty on an employer of $100 if you don't return it. Now, Representative Gunther, who's on the committee, advisory council said, okay, it's a good idea, but make sure that notice specifically says if you don't return it, there will be a $100 penalty. We think this will incent employers to return it, thus detecting fraud, reducing the amount of fraud, and being able to recoup the fraud over payments. The third section I'd like to bring up in policy is Section 15 on page 34. The department had received a grant. Dislocated Worker Program has received a grant for $5 million to provide entrepreneurial services to individuals who want to start their own business. But an individual cannot collect unemployment benefits if that's what they're attempting to do. This waives the requirements so that an individual who is working through the Dislocated Worker Program to start their own business can, in fact, receive unemployment benefits while in that program. It's limited to individuals who are over 50 years of old, 50 years of age and is limited to a maximum of 500 individuals, and there is a sunset on that particular provision of 2 years. But that's to comply with a federal grant. There's only a couple of provisions in the housekeeping technical changes of Article 4 I would like to highlight very, very quickly for you. One is on page, it's in section 10 on page 38 and 39. What happened there was the Department of Labor has ruled that that section or that particular clause is out of conformity with federal law. Under the commissioner's authority in 268.23, that was stricken. So that law, that particular provision, has no force in effect, so therefore we are removing it from the statute. There is some new language on page 49 and 50 and 51. It looks like it's new. It is not. What happened, I'd sent to the revisor's office a strikeout, but there were so many strikeouts in that section because it was all outdated, outmoded language and obsolete that the revisor said, no, let's repeal the whole section and reprint it as a new section. The repealed section is 268.086, and it's been reprinted as 268.0865. And those are the highlights of the particular Articles 3 and Article 4.
I have a question from Senate Counsel.
Mr. Chairman, this is a technical question, members. On Section 15, page 34, line 22, the expiration date, is that expiration date, is that intended to serve as a cutoff of benefits or as a cutoff of the authority to allow the recovery of benefits under that section? It's unclear, so we should probably make it clear.
That was simply, I believe that no new person could enter into the program at that particular time. And actually, the grant expires in 2011. But we asked for an extension because we believe that grant will be extended. But as I understand it, the intent is so that nothing new could be added to that grant. But that was the intent. But actually, the grant itself will actually expire, current grant, in 2011. Simply wanted authority to go because we believe that grant will be extended. Because part of the problem is we need this legislation to implement it. We already have the $5 million grant sitting there. We can't implement it without this particular piece of legislation.
Senate Counsel.
Mr. Nelson, and so on line 23, should we add? So the intent is that if somebody is in the program on the week before June 20th, 2012, they can continue to receive their benefits until that endowment runs out? Or is that what you said? It wasn't clear to me.
That was the intent when this was drafted, but I'd have to look at what the federal grant actually would provide. But we could certainly, you know, it certainly suggests that this committee do that, but the federal grant is going to control what actually happens. But we wouldn't want the statutory authority to expire before the grant expires.
Let's keep an eye on that.
Okay,
we'll
look
Senator
at that.
Thomas on his committee, and if it needs fixing up, we'll agree at this level that's acceptable. Are you through the bill? It looks like this. We've added the 09 amendment, but it looks like there. Where did this come from, the board, or was this discussed? And looks like there's a little punch to it. And we accepted it already, but tell me about it, would you, somebody?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this particular amendment, for the most part, was brought forward by an advocacy group, Legal Aid, asked for it. And they are a member of the UI Advisory Council. We have talked with the state chamber. We've talked with the AFL-CIO on this particular amendment. It puts most of the language is comfort language. We do most of it currently. But they wanted it very clear in the statute what's required in various notices, what an unemployment law judge is required to do at the beginning of the hearing. They wanted that made very clear, even though they do it now. They want it in the statute. The one thing which is not currently done, it deals with subpoenas and how you handle a subpoena which is refused. The department gets thousands of requests for subpoenas prior to hearings. A good share of them are denied because we get requests to subpoena the president at 3 a.m. We don't subpoena people who won't have any direct testimony involved. But this requires the unemployment law judge, on his own motion or her motion, to look at that subpoena which has been denied during the course of the hearing and to determine during the course of the hearing whether that subpoena should be granted. If it is determined at that point to be relevant material to the disposition of the case, the unemployment law judge must continue the case, issue the subpoena, and get that information.
Did the board approve this, or did you just go round and round and talk to people?
Mr. Chairman, this was not brought forward to us until first part of February, and we brought it up with virtually everyone on the
Legal Aid brought it forward, but the Chamber of Commerce
Has seen this. We sat and talked with Tom Hesse about it. Sat and talked with Brad Latto about it and Jennifer Solbach about it.
I suppose it's good enough. Usually it's ratified by the board, not here. Well, Senator Day.
I would move the bill. I spent a good amount of time reading the 70-plus pages. I'm sorry I missed what Mr. Fuller brought up, but it's a really good bill. So.
Well, you were reading it when we were talking about Owatonna earlier today. You were digging
into
this.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I would like to acknowledge that not only did Senator Day read the bill, but he co-authored the bill. So.
I think that's what he read.
Let's ask
He didn't really read it. Oh, now the truth comes out.
We better ask more questions.
He pretended like he read it. Okay, on the day motion, I think this is this going to be full finance, and then I think they send it down to on the day motion as amended. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, folks.
Thank
Good
you.
Work.
Thank you.
David, Mr. Tomasoni, go ahead.
Yeah.
Because you're listed next, so. Which, you got Senate File 1197, or which one? You take whichever one you want first.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, let's go with 1197.
Okay, Senator. Thomas, Senator, 1197.
I have two amendments to put in the shape that I would like to put it in. First, the A2 amendment. I'd move the A2 amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, that. We'll move the amendment, the A2 amendment. All in favor of Thomasoni's amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Senator.
And then the A3 amendment is another conformity language amendment. I'll move the A3 amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, on the A3 amendment, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Tomasoni, discussion.
Mr. Chairman, the Senate File 1197 is the Unemployment Insurance Federal Stimulus Fund Conformance Bill, and basically what it does is it makes sure that we can get the $130 million from the federal government that was in the stimulus package into the UI fund so that it can be distributed in Minnesota. We had about four different ways to do it, so we took the cheapest way, and I think we spend about $1 million overall in order to get about $130 million. And so it's a bill that we want to pass as quickly as possible so that we can get to the federal money as quickly as possible. I know that once we get the $130 million, I think we make $400,000 or $500,000 in interest in the fund as soon as it gets in there. So per month, $400,000 to $500,000 per month. So it's a big bonus to the state, and it doesn't have to be paid back to the federal government. And then there's the amendment we put on allows some people to get some training too that otherwise wouldn't be able to get some training. So it's one of those kind of bills I think that we just got to kind of move through and I'll let Mr. Nelson give you the particulars on the bill, and hope we can just move it out of here quickly.
Seconded, Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the bill was originally drafted by the department, and we worked with Senator Tomasoni on it. This bill, I should tell you, while it is part of the federal stimulus, has been pending in Washington for over 2 years. It was simply moved into the stimulus bill, so it is not something new. But the Department of Labor, I will tell you, I was on the phone with them for an hour this morning, and that's where one of these amendments came from. They are very particular. You have to dot every I, cross every T, use exactly the language that they require. What happens once the legislation passes, we then submit an application to the Department of Labor, and they have 30 days in which to give it the thumbs up or the thumbs down as to whether it complies. And once they rule it does comply, they will have the money put in the unemployment insurance trust fund within 7 days. The sooner it is on deposit in the unemployment insurance trust fund, it will start earning interest because the fund still has a positive balance. That $130 million will earn $100,000 in interest a week. So the sooner the money is in there, the sooner it will earn $100,000 a week. As part of the information we've given to staff to pass out, because Senator Michelle had asked for it last week, was the status of the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. With the latest projections, the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund is scheduled, projected to go into deficit status the first part of December of 2009. It will be $1.5 billion in deficit in 2011. There's some serious issues in the trust fund. $130 million won't save the trust fund, but it will certainly help. But those are issues which will, I know I've already discussed it with the commissioner at length. We're having a meeting even next week on it. But we will be coming forward next year with some legislation regarding the trust fund. But this will help the trust fund. These are all, as Senator Tomasoni indicated, Minnesota, well, all states, you have four options. You have to do two of four options. Minnesota already has one of those options, which deals with part-time work. The remaining three options available, the particular option which was chosen, which is separation due to compelling family reasons that an individual is not denied, will increase benefits by about $400,000 to $500,000 per year. That's our estimate. The other two options, one of those options would have cost $40 to $50 million a year in additional benefits, and the other option somewhere is around $20 million per year. So, as the Senator indicated, it's the administration's position to go forward with the least expensive options at this point. If the legislature decides later to adopt those other particular options, the legislature can do that at any time.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Shiat.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask a question, and I'm embarrassed because it may have been answered when Mr. Nelson was talking about Senator Bonoff's bill, because I see some of the same language in here, and it has to do with the employee misconduct language. And if I could, and I forgive me if you did clarify this already, but it's the last bit of new language under that section, and it says, well, I see it. First of all, earlier in that section, it takes out the language, a single incident that does not have a significant impact on the employer. And then it puts in other language. It says an important fact which must be considered in deciding if the applicant's conduct rises to the level of employment misconduct is whether or not they were discharged because of a single incident. That doesn't take me anyplace. I don't know if that means if it's just one incident, they're more or less likely, I assume less likely, to be disqualified, but I can't tell for sure.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scheid, actually, that single incident this was part of the advisory council language, so there is some overlap, and we're going to have to fix that little bit of an overlap in these bills. Let me try to explain it. The problem with the single incident is some of the arguments which weren't anticipated, which are being argued in the Court of Appeals all the time. We had a case involving a pilot at a major airline in Minnesota who was drunk.
Mm-hmm.
And his attorney, very prominent lawyer, employment lawyer, argued that was only a single incident and there was no harm to the employer. He literally argued the plane didn't crash. Was the argument. No harm. No harm, no foul. He only did it once. And the court has issued numerous cases under that. It's getting very complex. We simply want to remove it, but say, hey, a single incident has to be considered. But it isn't. So that's where we feel this cleans up some of those cases. I don't think it's going to change the actual outcome of anything, but it simply removes some of the arguments that creative lawyers can make in the Court of Appeals. That's where that language comes from, and we're trying to, say, eliminate some of the creative arguments that attorneys make.
We've got a creative lawyer smiling over here, to my right, to your left.
And Mr. Chairman,
Senator Scheidt,
Chairman, I guess I'm just being difficult. I'm just not sure what that means, whether or not they were discharged because of a single incident. In other words, that's an important fact. So does that mean if it was something that was just a single incident, but it was really egregious, like flying an airplane drunk, or it was forgetting to empty a wastebasket one night and you're supposed to do it every night. I mean, whatever. I think I know what it means, but I'm not. It just the language doesn't say that to me. Is that what you mean, though? Is that what that's intended to mean?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scheidt, yes. Employers put forth rules. If you do this, you'll be fired. And we want to make it clear, if it's minor, it's not misconduct. But if it's a major item, that it is. And we're simply saying, I think this gets at that intent a lot better than the previous language. And I'll have to admit, I wrote the previous language. I shouldn't have written it the way it was in hindsight, come to find out. What we're trying to get at is people should consider, gee, if it only happened once, is it really misconduct?
Right.
But in certain instances, yes. Showing up for work drunk when you're a pilot, yes. There was another incident which in the Court of Appeals, involving a cashier who stole $4 from the employer.
Can you word it differently?
And one of the arguments was, it's simply a single incident. Well, the court said, a single incident, but it has a significant adverse effect on the employer, not because the dollars amounted to much, but they could no longer trust the worker.
Okay.
You can't trust a cashier who's stealing from you. And so they said that's why there's the impact on the employer. We've had other incidents in which the Court of Appeals has said swearing at your employer and refusing to do a job was not because it was a single incident. And you go, a little bit of a problem with that particular individual. But that case involved a person who washed cars at a car dealership. And I think, quite frankly, what the court said is there's a 50-some-year-old guy whose job it is to wash cars for $8 an hour. Do we want to deny him unemployment benefits simply because he told the boss where to go in no uncertain terms when the boss tried to interrupt his buffing a car?
Okay.
Those are the kinds of cases you're getting at. We're simply saying, we have to consider that it's a single incident, but we want to clarify the law so that it makes it a little easier for everyone to operate.
Thank you.
Senator Bonnef.
I had a question, but first a follow-up to Senator Scheidt's comment. I wonder if it wouldn't be more clear if the language read something like conduct rises to the level of employment misconduct that resulted in employee being discharged. Isn't that what you're talking about, that the actual incident resulted in being discharged rather than a broader identification of single incident, or no, Senator Scheidt?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheidt.
Mr. Chairman, I zeroed in on this. I have a friend who lost her job a month or so ago and was turned down for unemployment, and it was a one-time deal, and she wasn't working as hard as she should have that day because she had a sore back, so she got up to take a break, and her employer said, that's unacceptable, you're out of here, and she was turned down. She's on appeal. You know, I don't want to, that's obviously as much as I can say about it, but it was a one-time thing, and she had never gotten anything, you know, any kind of warning like that. So it just interested me to know we used to have that kind of a protection about a single incident, but I certainly understand we don't want to go back to drunk pilots. You know.
Senator Scheid, the Senate counsel is not putting his arms around
my concern.
No, he is.
Oh.
Yeah, I didn't say it right. He thinks that you have a legitimate concern.
Well, I'm concerned about the language, Mr.
But
Chairman.
That,
just said it's
so
a little
is,
ambiguous.
So is okay. Mr. Fuller. So I think
okay.
we want to...
We work on it. And it's actually it's in her bill, too.
It might be just
Senator
a little
Ronald's
bit too much now to fix up, he says. It may take him a...
Well, Mr. Chairman.
And then a question to Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, this has to come to my committee, too. So
that's where we're headed toward, I think.
You know, I think we can work together and figure out how to do this. Unless Mr. Fuller's coming up with something right now. But.
And then, Mr. Chairman, a separate question, and I think I'll need counsel's interpretation for this as well. With the definition of immediate family, are step family members included in that definition?
We've got some definitions somewhere in law. Would you know the answer to that?
Mr. Chair, I believe it's defined.
Defined in here?
Is it? I believe it's defined.
Or somewhere else in law?
Mr. Chairman, in here it says immediate family member means the applicant's spouse, parent, son or daughter, or grandson or granddaughter, and it doesn't make a distinction step, not steps.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, I don't think that it does cover step children, then maybe that should be included.
Mr. Chairman, and Senator Tomasoni, I'm particularly sensitive, being the mother of a blended family. I've raised my stepchildren since they were little. I just would assume, I would presume we would want to include stepchildren as children, and perhaps they already are under law.
Senator Bonoff, make a motion. We'll take it. Add it in there.
Mr. President, I move that we add the words.
Good. Good work.
Means the applicant's spouse and then step. Parent, son or daughter, grandson, granddaughter, so that step would go through all of those words.
Well, that's good. Make sure it's in here.
Okay, so Mr. Chairman, I think this is your intent. You want to add stepson or stepdaughter?
Mr. Chairman, I would presume you'd want to include step for all of them, but I'm most concerned about stepson or daughter.
Okay. Agreeable? All those in favor? Signify.
What are we doing?
Okay, yeah, doing
step parent or step daughter or son?
Step family.
Or you could just add necessarily foods.
Never.
You have an idea? State, what we're going to do. Oh, your microphone.
My understanding is on line 1.6 of the amendment that we would, after parent, comma, add the term step-parent, and after the daughter, comma, we'd add step-son or stepdaughter, comma.
Okay. Discussion on that? Good work. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. And now, Senator Latz.
I'll just comment, Mr. Chairman, that it's a good thing we have creative lawyers to try to sort some of these statutes out, because as we see, there are times when the statutes are a bit ambiguous, and the purpose of the statute as a whole, the legislative purpose of this, is to cover people with financial support when they lose their jobs, and sometimes you need to push the limits a little bit and let the courts apply facts to specific situations, even if they might appear on their face to be a bit absurd. So,
flying a plane.
And Mr. Chairman, now that my son's a lawyer, I like creative lawyers. So. Oh,
they've done nothing but complicate my life.
Okay, we're going to move this out, but we've There's two issues. I think Senator Scheid brought up one, and there was one a little earlier. And we're going to look. We got your word that Senator Thomasoni and that we're going to try to fix those that language up when it gets to your committee.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'll move then that Senate File 1197 be recommended to pass and be as amended and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Okay, on further discussion? On the motion, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. How long is your next one, as long as you're sitting there?
Depends on Carnival.
Where is it?
That, the guy with the little yellow car? Oh, not in the winter time, are you? Okay, we'll proceed to Senate File 698, Senator Thomasoni. Small Business Growth Acceleration Program eligibility.
And Mr. Chairman, I'll let my witnesses go ahead and describe this, but basically what this is, it's a request for some growth acceleration program money and to show how it has worked and how we can expand it to more companies and how we can help them. The way that this worked is that the gap financing, which is what they call this, which is short for Growth Acceleration Program, was used to help businesses grow. And it actually gives a really good return on the money that's invested. And we're trying to make it apply to more people and more companies so that we can actually employ more people and have a bigger bang for the buck. And so what I'll do is I'll turn this over to Mr. Kill, and he can explain what's been going on.
Thank you, Senator, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'll try to be brief, though, as those of you that have heard me talk before, you realize that's hard for me to do. When talking about this passionate subject, Enterprise Minnesota, some of you know us as Minnesota Technology, works with manufacturers to help them achieve operational excellence and compete in what's a global economy. At the same time, really focused on retaining and adding jobs. With me today are two witnesses who have used this program in the past. The previous program that has really been fully utilized was $750,000 in a one-time grant. And we have assisted just about 70 companies now in the past almost 2 years. It was a one-for-one grant of our services. We are a nonprofit that is fee-based, so we charge manufacturers for our fees to help them make their operation as efficient as possible so that they can invest in the skills of their people and grow their business. And we hope to, especially in this time, retain jobs, but in better times to grow jobs. Our minimum impact, we consider for every dollar invested by a company that they should see a $15 return. The two witnesses today will actually speak about that at the very low level of what they expect. It is a program that's very results-driven. In other words, 6 months to 12 months after a service is completed that our experts work with the company on, they will receive an independent survey chartered by the federal government to judge the results in four main categories: retained jobs, added jobs, bottom line savings, and top line growth. And we as an organization, as part of a federal program of 59 affiliates, we get graded every quarter accordingly. And it's like buying a car. If you don't get an excellent grading from the person buying the car, it's a failure. So we always have to get 100% approval on both all four of those categories. I think in this committee there are six members who have visited some of these companies in the past few months. We actually were nice enough to have 24 legislators visit 18 companies, and the comments that the CEOs and VPs of operations make really speak for themselves, I think. So, you know, our goal with the request for $3 million is to reach a larger constituency. We've broken into three categories because one of the challenges in the past, we did not get to enough small companies, sub 50 employees. They take longer to spend a dollar than one that's a larger company. So we're asking for a three-for-one match for the small company under 50 employees, a one-for-one match when it's 50 to 100 employees,
and then a one-for-three match for 100 to 250 employees, because that really is the core. That's 100% of the small, medium-sized manufacturers in the state of Minnesota. With me today, I have two CEOs and vice presidents from two companies that have taken advantage of this program, and I think it's better said in their words what they see as the value. So to my right is Chuck Rowell from RIE Coatings in Eden Valley. To my left, Brandon Anderson from Von Rudin Manufacturing in Buffalo, and we'll start with Brandon if we could.
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you. My biggest fear was it's Mr. Chair and Committee, but then when the ladies takes the chair, the woman takes the chair, what does it change to?
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Brandon Anderson. I'm Vice President of Von Rudin Manufacturing in Buffalo and proud to be operating out of Wright County. I'm here today to express our strong support for this Growth Acceleration Program bill. Companies like mine throughout this state represent the critical core that guides our manufacturing sector. In these challenging economic times, it is small and medium-sized manufacturing who typically retain jobs longer and are oftentimes the most reactive to reinstate and create the new jobs. We have been around for over 60 years. We've grown, we've evolved, and over those years, we have succeeded in remaining a small, family-owned manufacturer, and most importantly, in the state of Minnesota. We manufacture components that are used in industrial mobile markets, typically construction equipment, conveying systems, commercial agricultural equipment, and recently the machine tool industry or manufacturing industry. As a supplier to these markets, we are one of only a handful that do all their processes in the United States and the only one in the state of Minnesota that completes all its processes here. We employ engineers, salespeople, machinists, and various other trade and clerical positions. 90% of our employees reside within a half-hour drive, and I've worked with them, with over half of them, for more than 15 years. We're important to Minnesota, we're important to Wright County, and most importantly, we're important to the city of Buffalo. We contribute to local needs and technology, including donations, grants, and projects to schools, libraries, along with apprenticeship programs at all levels of education, not including the safety donations and support for the policemen and firefighters. We also contribute to the state by providing consistent reinvestment back into our business for the benefit of the employees and also the community for which we live. Our sales range from 5 to 9 million, and our staffing range from 40 to 75, dependent on market and conditions. Unfortunately, we're currently operating at the lower end of both of those. However, we have opportunities that are in front of us to not only sustain the level that we're at in this economy, but to actually increase our operating levels even in this downturn in market. We have resources available in technology, expertise, labor, experience, and most importantly, desire. However, access to funding to support these growth opportunities is essential and is turning to be proven extremely difficult. The downturn in the financial sector has finally hit and is holding a grasp on the manufacturing here in Minnesota. The less resources that are available, the tighter covenants, and the lengthier approvals have not helped our Minnesota manufacturing companies react, including Von Rudin. The Growth Acceleration Program is one such resource that can provide such a spark. An influx of money can solve a short-term dilemma. However, an investment tied with responsibility will get us through this long-term. Manufacturing in the state does have opportunities, and they're within reach, even during these difficult times. Von Rudin, we just represent one of many that are out there. The GAP bill will provide access to funding to complete these projects that are needed. Stable and growing businesses, they always need and they always spend, and that's what we're trying to reach. Enterprise Minnesota and their staff is in place to facilitate these funds and to ensure the projects of security and that there's a return on the investment by the state. A company with an immediate need and a company with a market opportunity and a company that is willing to invest. Enterprise Minnesota recognized these points when they visited Von Rudin last year. Working with Harry Larson and Bob Kill, we've implemented three programs this past year that will not only stabilize us, but will open doors to turn opportunities into investment. We have one such market in the machine tool arena that opens the door to $60 million market just in U.S. sales alone. Von Rudin has already staged for completion of this project by product development is being done, Inventory is already in place on the shelf, and relationships are well underway. Von Rudin is the only supplier for this market with the hydraulic and mechanical expertise, and we're the only one that we can say made in USA, and we're the only one, obviously, can say made in Minnesota and made in Buffalo. However, to complete our movement forward and to compete with our larger international competitors, we must become ISO compliant. To compete with our larger manufacturers, we also must represent our products in a larger manner as updating our literature, catalog, website, and marketing materials. In a down market when financial strength is stressed and stretched, funding to complete these projects with outside companies is just a great challenge right now. The funding of the GAP program and the commitment from Enterprise Minnesota are the needed resources to complete these goals and to stabilize our growth. I remember talking with Enterprise Minnesota last fall. Enterprise Minnesota is committed to ensuring that this program achieves its full potential. I come before this committee to let you know, with all honesty, that we expect to have a return of $40 for every dollar spent. In past years, the program has had a minimum return of $15. And with any luck in the market changing over into 2010 and 2011, we expect those returns to reach beyond $65 for every dollar. It's just good business sense. I'm not here to tell the committee that our company or our employees are more worthy than one other sector or one other situation. But as a participating member of the GAP program, I'm here to convey that the returns are real. And I'm also here to tell the committee that the return on investment for such a program is what Minnesota manufacturers like ourselves need. And I'm here to tell the committee that we represent just one of many of us out there that have opportunity and have the commitment to make it succeed. On behalf of the employees of Von Rudin, the residents of Buffalo and Wright County, and the manufacturers that are not able to be here with us, I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Rao?
My name is Chuck Rao. I'm the president of
Mr. Rao, can you come to the microphone?
Surely. Okay, my name is Chuck Rao. I'm the president of RIE Coatings in Eden Valley, Minnesota. I'm here for a couple of reasons today to speak in support of the Growth Acceleration Program. Number one, because of the significant impact it's had on my company, but as importantly, is a strong belief that I've got that this type of activity is really a core solution to the current economic situation that we are into. Small companies that are in position to grow are going to be able to grow faster than larger companies. We're going to be able to create jobs faster, and the key to recovery is going to be creating jobs. So about my company, RIE Coatings, a small metal finishing company, again in Eden Valley, specifically thin film coating application, which is as much as anyone wants to know about what I do. We have about 51 employees, which I found out today puts me in another bracket of engagement with this proposal. But it's significant to note that 10% that in the last quarter of last year, that employee number grew 10%. Through the year, we shipped about $4 million a product, which was an 18% growth over the year before.
Congratulations.
Thank you. We feel quite good about it. In fact, our 2009 budget, we're looking for an additional 25% growth. Now, given the economy caught up to us the last couple of months, and I'm beginning to understand that our core customers are going to disappoint us this year, but we have significant growth opportunities, projects that we're working on that should propel us to growth for the year. Whether we get to 25 is going to be a challenge, but we have a lot, us like many other small companies, have a lot of projects that we're very optimistic about. So here we are. We're a small business. We're looking to grow. The realization that I've had in this company, I've only been with it for a little over a year now. It's the first engagement I've had with a company this small, is the phrase cash is king. I used to hear it. Now I believe it. Now I live it every day. Cash is ultimately what is going to decide everything that we can do, and ultimately how many jobs we can provide. Because of the significance of cash, investment in your business has to be done very carefully, very pragmatically, and dollars have to be used very wisely. The way that Enterprise Minnesota and particularly this GAP program has been able to impact us is, number one, the dollar assistance on making investments in our company. has lessened the risk in any investment that we would make. Secondly, and as significantly, working with an Enterprise Minnesota, they are bringing qualified, reliable, credible resources to the table to work with us to work through these projects. I'm a pretty conservative guy, and I struggle with a lot of consultants that are out in the industry. We have great faith in the resources that Enterprise Minnesota brings to bear. And that combination of dollar assistance plus the reliance on the resources has really provided the leverage that's let RIE make the decision to invest in programs to improve our company. Okay, so what are these programs? We've had four engagements with Enterprise Minnesota in the year plus that I've been there. First and most significantly, a lean synchronous flow production process that we went through. Learned about some approaches to manufacturing that we applied to our business and had profound, almost immediate impact on our business and our ability to perform. We took our lead times from 6 to 8 week lead times that was failing in the marketplace and turned it down to 1 week turnaround time on work. At the same time, we increased our capacity 75% in our operation, and obviously with increased productivity of our people. That permitted us to reestablish ourselves in a market. This company was struggling 2 years ago, and now we're seen as a good, viable, healthy, and reliable company again. And all of that obviously has solidified our workforce and, again, in fact, permit us to grow in a year when that has not been the case in most areas. So a significant impact out of our engagement with Enterprise Minnesota. Secondly, ISO certification, as Brandon mentioned, it's becoming table stakes. If you want to be a credible supplier, you've got to be there. And we had our pre-certification audit just yesterday, and we're in line to get our full certification in April. This is going to open up whole new marketplaces to us, including the military, which is one of the solid places to go get business, and wind energy, another growing marketplace that is going to help us move into those market segments. We had an engagement with Unique Selling Proposition Marketing Strategy, and this helped us get our arms around what is the strength of our value proposition. How should we be presenting ourselves to the industry, and how should we do that? And organizing our sales efforts. Those efforts have resulted in new customers coming on board. And also deeper penetration from existing customers, significant impact in the workflow coming in. Last but not least, we're working on website strategy. And this is something that we're right in the middle of this project right now, looking at we got an education on the strategies of website that we had not known before. We're working on redesigning and redeveloping that website that's going to increase traffic to our site and obviously drive more business through our site. So all of these programs have either had or will have profound, significant impact on our ability to succeed. And I can, again, as I said earlier, I'm a very conservative person and very leery of consulting engagements. I can guarantee you anyone in this room, and I can look at the eye and say, these are investments that we would not have yet made in our company had we not had a partner like Enterprise Minnesota to move forward with. It's a combination of the dollars and the confidence and the assistance has enabled us to make moves that I wouldn't have taken otherwise. So the last question, do you see value in any enterprise or any program? Well, when we look at the business place, the best indicator of success, the best indicator of your customer satisfaction is, would your customer recommend you to someone else? And I can, again, stand before everyone and say that I have, in fact, and continue to recommend engagement with Enterprise Minnesota, with the GAP program, any place that I see a fit for my cohorts in the business area.
So, well, thank you very much, Mr. Rao.
Well, add a little class to this side.
Madam Chair, I would assume that I'm being looked at and asked, where are you going to get the $3 million from?
Senator Tomasoni, that is what I was wondering.
Okay, and I'm not sure just yet, but I will tell you this. I think anytime you hear things like a 65-to-1 return on your money or that you're saving jobs or creating jobs in this jobless economy, that at the very least we have to give it a shot and keep the bill alive to see if there's somewhere we can find it. Now, there are some federal stimulus funds coming in from the area of the workforce development, and I'm not sure if this qualifies for it just yet, but this might be an area where we can move some of the funds and possibly do some kind of funding. With $750,000 last year, there was some significant work done, and both of these gentlemen were recipients of the money and can give you some and gave you some very good reasons why the program should continue. So I could read some quotes from some senators on the committee, but that
well, Senator Thompson, I do have some questions from members on the committee, so I'll call on
them. Go ahead.
And also, Senator Thompson, I just want to remind you that when the Commissioner of Finance was here and talking about the stimulus money and talked particularly about the grant process and said that he would get back to us with regard to how we could have access to some of those funds, so I would also suggest you pursue that.
Thank you.
Senator Saltzman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank you, Senator Thomas, for carrying this bill, because as some of us have been talking with our businesses across Minnesota, and we are concerned that some of our traditionally larger companies, our Fortune 500 companies, have told us that they are moving manufacturing to where the client base is, not to say that they're not keeping many of those facilities here, but as they expand. And so when I see a bill like this, this is how we really grow the small businesses and really invest in those that are producing products here in Minnesota and also the region. So in terms of economic development and really recovery, this is where we absolutely have to invest. And I know it's really hard because we have this incredible deficit to deal with, but as we've talked about in this committee, how do we also grow our way out of this? And trying to find dollars to invest in here, whether it's federal or really looking hard under every cushion we can for those extra, you know, dollars is very, very important. So I want to thank the testifiers today for really telling us about how there are good things going on in Minnesota, and we can't forget that, and we have to support those. So thank you to all of you, Mr. Kill, as well, for your work with Enterprise Minnesota.
Thank you, Senator Koch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just echo what Senator Saltzman was saying. I had an opportunity to tour Von Ruden, and I can vouch for the 40-1. I saw the numbers myself. I consider myself also somewhat conservative. And when I saw the numbers, I got excited. These were very exciting numbers. And it was absolutely a but for Enterprise Minnesota. I think, Mr. Anderson, you had taken a run at ISO certification previously and not completed the process, correct? And so if it were not for Enterprise Minnesota, this would not have happened. This door would not be open for them. And they were. It was very exciting to see, and they were excited about their prospects. And that was all in due to this program. I think that it is going to be private enterprise that's going to eventually – this is going to be the key to growing us out of this. And so this is a program that we could do a little bit to leverage those kind of dollars in the private industry. I think it's important.
Thank you. Senator Scheid.
Well, Madam Chair, as a probably more moderate than Mr. Rao, but nobody ever calls me a liberal except my opponents, which is crazy. But anyway, I think Mr. Kill was here earlier this session, and we talked about the value of the program. But Mr. Rao and Mr. Anderson gave just excellent testimony as to why a small amount leverages so much, and so I hope that members feel that there are some things we can't afford not to do, and if we are going to work our way out of this, this is one of those kinds of things that instead of pouring, you know, $40 in and getting a dollar out, you know, we're doing the reverse. That's smarter money, and so I hope that. Well, it's Senator Tomasoni's hands, I guess, and for him to duke it out with the chair of finance. But I just want you to know I'm very enthusiastic about this.
And Senator Tomasoni, our bet's on you.
I like that.
Senator Saltzman.
Yes, another question, Madam Chair. As you mentioned, Mr. Rao, that now that you're going over 50, there's different parameters here. But one of the things that we also heard, and Chair Metzen's done an excellent job of pulling some smaller groups together for us to talk to business. We were talking to a group of small business owners, and one of them did talk about that there's this magic number of 50, and that it was in relation to a number of different issues that sometimes there's a disincentive to grow, that in a number of places where I think it was 50 was the number he used, was why would I want to go over that? because of different regulations and things. So I think that's something, too. I know you mentioned it in terms of this bill and funding, but if there's other situations that you think we can deal with as a state, maybe not today, but if you could follow up with us or afterwards with what those issues are, because we wouldn't want to disincentivize people from growing their businesses.
Thank you. Madam Chair, then I'll move Senate File 698 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Very good. So Senator Tomasoni moves Senate File 698 be recommended to pass. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Bill is passed. Thank you.
Thank you much, Madam Chair and Committee.
Senator Shide. The
Democrats are talking to business.
Oh, absolutely.
Until the session's all done. I'll take them.
When I come back, okay.
My sentiment was on the
other. I learned something.
Yeah, that's right.
It's wonderful, though, when I hear it.
Well, sometimes there are success stories.
There are. Look for everyone came in and see you, then I. You saw me see you.
And that small amount of dough we put out. They did a hell of a job.
I agree.
Yeah.
That's the amendment.
Senator Scheid.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I do have an amendment. This is a Department of Labor and Industry. This is the construction code cleanup bill. I've been coming with a few construction code cleanup bills for a few years now. This could be the third year or so. But, you know, we did a recodification and cleanup a number of three or four years ago, and now we're just continuing to, we're looking for perfection. So I'd like to move that I think it's the 0051, the A09-0051 amendment. Put it in the shape I'd like it.
Senator Scheid moves the A09-0051 amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment's passed. Senator Scheid.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as I said, this has to do with chapters having to do with construction codes, and I think we have some licensing issues taken up in this bill. Mr. Joachim from the department is here, and Assistant Commissioner, am I correct?
Correct.
And can go through the technical pieces. I don't know that you want to hear each and every one. I know that members may have a concern about one or another provision, but we can maybe touch on those.
Thank you.
Do you mind?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Joachim.
I'm Tom Joachim, Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. We prepared a brief bill summary, a front and back, and it's listed House File 927, Senate File 1004, and that is addressing the bill and the just amendment just that amendment. You just passed, removed. So if it's okay with Madam Chair, I'm just going to walk through the two-page summary.
Very good.
And again, referencing back to what Senator Scheid was mentioning, this is a cleanup to the cleanup as we consolidated five different state agencies. We've, over the last 3 years, have found pieces that don't match up, and we need to clarify them to make them fit correctly. The Section 1 addresses that. We found some language that's used the term service instead of issuance when we are issuing orders, so we want to correct it to match up with everything. Section 2 is an amendment which would allow us now to look at people that are working, that are required to have a license to do plumbing or electrical work and are advertising to do electrical or plumbing work or any other licenses that we issue on their vehicle that would allow us to go back and address, say, you know, you're not supposed to be doing that. Here's the issues that we need to address per our licensing criteria. Section 3 is an amendment addresses some a statewide building code bill last year that was carried by Senator Bach. The
The statewide building code bill carried the state building code now as a standard across the state. So even though it may not be enforced all over the state, it carries it across the state. We had, again, back to the five different state agencies, the plumbing code language for law probably came into the state in 1940s, and it had some old language that addressed that the plumbing provisions inside a single-family home that was hooked up to a septic and well system didn't have to comply to the code. And so this changes that. It would make it that no matter where you are in the state of Minnesota, any plumbing work that's installed any place in commercial or residential is required to comply to the code. That just corrects that. Sections 4, 6, 9, and 10 address a number of issues that came into play. The Department of Labor and Industry is responsible for the water conditioning and installers and licensors and contractors. The intent of the authoritative plumbing board was to have the plumbing board take care of that. We missed that in the assignment of the responsibilities to the plumbing board. We already have a water conditioning licensed installer contractor on the plumbing board. That was the intent. So this clarifies what that intent was. We're moving provisions to the plumbing board responsibility for water conditioning installers and contractors and for the licensing. And then we're clarifying that the plumbing board and what the responsibilities are of the commissioner for inspections, because that's still our responsibility, not the plumbing board. Section 5, in the process, again, the restricted journeyman plumber was included in the bond and insurance requirements. A journeyman plumber cannot contract for work, so they don't have to have a bond or insurance. So we're just taking that out of the language. Section 7, 8, and 11, this addresses, again, the exemption that came about 2 years ago. We used to have provisions in the law that allowed cities less than 5,000 were not required to have licensed plumbers or licensed water conditioning installers. 2 years ago, we went to statewide licensure for a restricted master plumber and restricted journeyman in communities less than 5,000. We missed the water conditioning contractors, so now this would pick up the water conditioning contractors that would be required to be licensed in those same communities. Just for some, there's been some question brought up about the original bills. The original sections 12 and 13 have been deleted out of the original bill, so that there were some questions from people that were concerned about that section. Right. New section 12, again, just some unnecessary wording, a typographical error in regard to a statute reference we're cleaning up. Section 13 reinserts the word owner-officer that was missed in the bill last year were not included. Section 14 clarifies the commissioner that the High Pressure Piping Board is responsible for issuance of permits. Again, when we are moving all this stuff, one of the paragraphs related to both, and the commissioner is responsible for permits, board's responsible for licensing and code adoption. Section 15 is a clarification, just a charge to make sure that the department is responsible for or able to be responsible for boiler inspections. There are 75-plus manufacturers and installers in Minnesota. They have the option of having their insurance company do the audits or having us do the audits. This just clarifies that we can do them and that we have to have the proper staff to do that. Section 17 requires the plumbing board to modify the plumbing code to include any provisions relating to water conditioning installers, and we are asking here for the good cause exemption process in the APA rule process, which allows a little shorter time frame to do the code adoption process for that. And section 18 is a repealer. We had the same provision in two different portions of the law, so we just were dropping one of them. This relates to the pipe layers and installers that can install the sewer and water pipe from the sewer mains to the building itself. And so we're just taking the duplicate language out of law. And that's what I have for today. And if there's any questions, I will sure try and answer them, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize. I'm not going to be able to pronounce it. Joachim. Joachim. I'm going to tell you, I've had as many complaints about the changes that were made last year with regard to this plumbing than I have as anything else. And it ranges from the resort owners who have been doing their plumbing for 35 years and they no longer can do it to the snowmobile club in Fauston that had a floor drain that they put in their cement floor that the volunteers were building that hooked up to a holding tank that the department came and told them they had to tear their cement floor out because they hadn't had it inspected before it was poured. What exactly have you been doing out in the rural areas to get notice out to people that these changes have occurred? And the reason I ask that is because the Snowmobile Club in Fauston, after they were there and they got this fine and were told they had to take out their cement floor, they went back to the county where they'd got their original permits. And, you know, the county permit people didn't even know about it. So is the department what kind of efforts are you doing to inform people that there have been these rule changes with regard to plumbers?
Madam Chair, Senator, I'll go back to the 2 years for the restricted master and restricted journeyman plumber. The application of those licenses applied to persons that already had a bond through us, or we were on our mailing list. We notified the resort owners. We notified the industry. We worked with the plumbing, heating, cooling associations to get information out. The pipe trades association to get information out to it. We are still having some people that haven't qualified for that, and I understand Representative Mahoney was looking at opening up the window again for the restricted master plumber to allow any others that didn't make that process to look at that. But we've tried to go through every organization we could to get information out to that.
Well, Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, and Mr. Joachim, the counties are the ones that do the majority of the permitting in the rural areas. And, a notice in some of these county bulletins or talk to AMC would have been extremely helpful. I'm very uncomfortable with Section 3 in your bill, where you're going to now expand what's currently going on to all of the rest of these rural areas. And I think you should have a little more time to work with the municipalities and the counties that are currently out there and try to get them on board and before you go to all the private farms and residences that are in the rural areas. I think you're overreaching a little bit, and so I'm going to I'll listen to your response, but at some point I'm going to remove to strike or delete Section 3.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Joachim.
Senator, the Section 3 does not require any more activity for the county or the township to do. This only says that whoever is installing it is required to comply to the code. So if there is a complaint from a homeowner or a commercial building owner that's having plumbing work done, we can then follow up to say, yes, you were required to, I guess it doesn't apply to commercial because it only applies to residential. You were required to install it to the standards of the plumbing code. There is no enforcement. There is no inspection required. This is only establishing this as the standard across the state, so that the exemption that used to be or is currently in law that says if you're hooked up to a septic well system, you don't have to comply to anything on the interior plumbing of a home. This just says you're supposed to comply to the code.
And, Madam, Mr. Chair, and yes, Mr. Joachim, so somebody's putting an addition on their house in an area where they have a septic and a well, and they're going to put laundry room on their house. What changes would be required for them with regard to having a plumber do the work or not?
Mr. Chair, Senator, no changes from what we're doing right now. It would only, if this is put in, this would say they were required to comply to the code. So let's say they sold a house 2 years from now and somebody went in and said, that plumbing's all messed up. You sold me a house, I thought the house was plumbed correctly, it wasn't. They could take them to court and say, you were required by this to install it to the plumbing code. Wasn't anybody out there to look at it.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Joachim, so currently they have, just bear with me because I'm not familiar with this. Currently they have to comply to the code, but they don't have to be inspected, or what's the current status without this change?
Mr. Chair, Senator, without this change, there is no requirement for the homeowner to comply to any portion of the plumbing code inside their home. And yet their well system and their septic system is required to be licensed and inspected.
So they can still do the work with this change? Do they need to have it inspected?
Mr. Chair, Senator, no, they can still do the work. You're allowed to do the work in your home that you're living in. And You would not have to have it inspected under this unless the county or township or city adopts the state building code to do enforcement.
Mr. Coy.
Well, Mr. Chair, also if the county adopts the state building code, then it would be another layer of
inspection, yes.
Inspection.
Yep. Correct, Senator.
Okay. Well, any further discussion? No.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator
Scheid. Mr. Chairman, obviously, I sit close to Senator Scoy.
Like he's a big guy,
and,
too.
You know, even on the floor. So, you know, I have to listen to him, and no, I will. And we'll talk about this.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid, I have to tell you, I've had a lot of complaints about people who used to do their plumbing, and now they can't anymore. And it's been pretty controversial.
And Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Chairman,
think we had some language a year or two ago about the restricted
plumbers.
And so that's the thing that you're saying that Representative Mahoney is looking at again. So I don't know if it would rise up in this bill, but probably, I'm guessing. So that's the issue, not really that they would be required to comply with the code. That's, I guess, all that Section 3 is saying. But your issue is really with that restricted license, and they may need more time.
So his would go further, Senator Mahoney's. Would be tougher, so to speak.
Mr. Chair, what Representative Mahoney is asking, he's had a couple of questions, too, from people that are currently unlicensed and didn't fit into the window for the restricted master or restricted journeyman, some of the resort owners that were actually doing their own plumbing work and missed the window because, again, we tried to notify everybody, but we're going to miss people. And so what Representative Mahoney has discussed with us a couple of days ago probably, that he's willing to open up the window again for a two-week or a month period for the handful that have contacted us that said they missed the window.
And, Mr. Chair, Mr. Joyce, I really would make an effort to get out to AMC.
Okay.
And also there would be no reason not to go to the League of Minnesota Cities because, I mean, those are the people where – people go for permits, and I was astounded when I talked to the Polk County guy, and he had never heard of it. And this was last fall, and I just thought, well, how can this be? And so really, and that, you know, that wouldn't be an expensive thing to do, just have them put it in their newsletter.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we work with the AMC and League of Cities and Townships. We probably sent it out, but we can redo it and get information out to them again.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move that Senate File 1004 as amended be recommended to pass. I think we took the finance piece out of the bill, so it's ready to go to.
Okay, to the floor. On the motion, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Are we through?
Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
When do we meet again? Okay, this committee meets next Monday at 12:30. Meeting's adjourned.